Father in heaven, we've come to you. We've gathered this morning to remember our Creator. We've come to worship. We've come to celebrate the life and the death and the resurrection of Christ, who wants to give us new life. And we know that you as our Father have our best interest in mind, and we want to look here at your word. We want to have our hearts touched and our lives moved, and that we would be perfected more and more into the image of Christ. Forgive us where we fail. Help us to do better in the future. We pray that you would perfect in us that work that you've started until that final day. When our work on this earth is done, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. It was a beautiful spring day when disaster struck the community. Three men who worked a day job in construction were about business as normal. The three fathers were glad for the opportunity to build this big building. It looked as if it would be a good step in their finances. Things had been going well, and if they continued, they would have all the roof metal on by evening. After lunch, as they were putting down the large sheets of roofing metal, the wind began to pick up, and as the afternoon wore on, the wind began to pick up, and it became more gusty, with dark storm clouds forming on the edge of the horizon. The men hurried, and while grabbing another sheet of metal and taking it to the ridge of the roof, the wind lashed out again, making the man carrying the sheet of metal lose his footing. The concrete was 30 feet below. Sam, Ben, and Joe were three brothers who lived in this community. I'd like to tell you a little about each of them. They grew up in a good home. They were spaced about 6 years apart in age, and they got along well, even though they had some differences. And they all wanted the best for their families. Sam wanted his children to grow up on a farm. He thought about his family, the goals and the aspirations, and he thought about all the things that a little farm can do for it. And there was many good reasons. He thought about responsibility. He thought about the family working together. He thought about all the things that they could do, they could learn. But farming is not as easy as it once had been. Land was expensive. But he thought the struggle would be worth it. And so Sam procured him a loan. He found a farm he thought would be suitable, and him and his young wife set up farming, and God blessed them with children. And as the years rolled along, they were able to make their payments on their farm. And it was hard at times. Sometimes the money barely stretched from month to month, but he felt like this was the best path forward. This is something that his father had done, that his grandfather had done, and he thought it was the best way to raise a family. And he still had a number of years to go, but God was good. He thought they would make it. Ben, being 6 years younger, he watched Sam. And he too wanted the best for his family. But there was something, things he noticed that bothered him. He watched Sam, he watched him struggle to make ends meet. And he saw the stress. Yes, there were some good things there, but what about this load of debt? And what about some of the things that Jesus had said? What about taking no thought for the morrow? And what about that, you know, God will take care of things, and you know, you need to commit your family to God. And he just wondered if the stress was really worth it all. And so he decided that for his family, he was going to opt on a little different path. He said that they would just find a house to rent. That was something, he had a good job, good day job. He could make the payments fairly easily, and there was some money left over, and he would be able to spend more time with his family. He wouldn't have all the stress of worrying about that, working from dawn to dusk every day. And, you know, he thought about Sam. Sam was often home, but he wondered how much he was really there worrying about everything. So He was going to put in his time on his job. He would go home, he could be with his family, and they could do things together. They could do camping trips. They could go visit people. There was things they would be able to do. And so that's the path he took. And they were able to do a lot of those things. They were able to go out west and see the Rockies and see those big geysers of water that come out. And it was just a good time for him and his family. And yeah, it pretty well burned up the check every month until they paid the rent, bought the groceries, and did a few things with family. The money was all gone, but there was work for tomorrow. So Joe really never had much in the bank account. They kind of spent it all. But Jesus said, take no thought for the morrow. Joe, being another 6 years younger, he watched Sam and he watched Ben. He tried to think about the path for his life. And he thought about the farm and he saw those things. I thought that was good. But he wasn't sure about the debt. And he thought about this thing that the borrower is servant to the lender. And he watched Joe, and Joe seemed to have some things going for him, but he wondered about Joe's children, how they would turn out with all that loose time and kind of the easy come, easy go with the money and not a lot of responsibility. Were they going to be able to be responsible when they grew up? And he wondered about all the things they were doing when Joe was, or when Ben was at work, and whether they were actually forming good habits. So he decided he's going to try a different path. He didn't want the stress of the debt. He wasn't sure it was good for relationships. But he decided he'd work. He would work hard, and he would save. And that's what Joe did. He worked hard, and he saved. And he would save his money, and they were watching. But land was expensive. But would you believe it? The perfect little homestead came up for sale. It wasn't very far down the road. And it was at a good price. Now, it was a little rundown, needed some work, but that was okay. He was willing to work hard. It was a really, really good deal. And it would take pretty much all of the money that they had scraped together to buy this whole place. But he was so excited about it. Finally, this dream that he had, they were going to have their own little place, and they weren't going to be in debt. He was going to have a good place for his children. The sale was next week. And that's when this disaster struck the community. The man that fell off the roof, he hit the concrete, and he ended up in the hospital. And there was a very, very large bill. He managed to pull through. They weren't sure how long he would be in rehab, whether they'd be able to even walk again. There was a lot of things they didn't know. But as Deacon Eli took the responsibility of trying to figure out how they're going to care for this man, for his hospital bill, for the future of the family. And he starts going around the community and he visits each of these fathers. He visits Sam and he visits Ben and he visits Joe. And he tells them, well, they knew what happened. He says, we're going to have to try to figure out what we can do here. He said, he'd been watching Sam. Sam worked hard. He didn't know exactly where things were at, but the farm looked like it was doing okay. So he talks to Sam. He says, Sam, is there anything you can do? And he says, you know what? My heart just went out to that family when that father fell from that roof. And we would really like to do a lot, but the reality is that we have this farm we bought, and we're making our payments, but we just really don't have a lot of extra money. We'd really like to help. And we've got a payment coming up due. We've tried to do what we can. There's not a lot we can do, but maybe we can put in a little. Here's $100. So Deacon Eli thanks him, and he goes on down the road. And he goes to Ben's house. And Ben knew about the accident already. And he knew that there was going to be some hard times for the family. And he wanted to help too. But they had just got back from the trip out west. And really, their money was all gone. And they had seen God's wondrous creation. And it was a blessing. But he didn't have a lot to put in, but he wanted to help. But when he opened his billfold, there just wasn't much in there. So he pulled out a little bit of money was left, and he handed it to the deacon. It was about $100. He knew he could go to work on Monday. And he hoped God could bless that. Joe, when the deacon Eli came to his house, he too knew about the accident. And he thought about the family and the suffering there and the hardships and the man that they weren't sure if he was going to ever walk again. And as Eli told him about the needs and how they're going, the family's not going to be able to reach around and pay all these bills and they're going to need help, Joe says his heart really went out to him. He really liked to help. But you know, he'd wanted a farm for his family and they had saved for years and years. And he had this money saved. And this perfect little farm would come for sale up at a price that you were not likely easy soon see again. And, you know, they had kind of set this money aside for that. And he didn't really have a lot extra. But he wanted to help the best he could. So he gave Deacon Eli $100. And Deacon Eli went down the road. So today, I'd like to talk about my father's business. Make sure we get this spelled right. I'm bad for getting my letters mixed up. Does that look good? Okay. I think we're all familiar with the passage, but let's turn there and read it. It's in Luke chapter 3. I'm sorry, Luke chapter 2. And we know the setting. They'd gone down to Jerusalem, Jesus' parents had, to for the Passover. And I guess a bunch of them had traveled together from Nazareth. As they started back, they supposed that Jesus was among the company. And after the first day of travel, they couldn't find him. Verse 44, chapter 2 and verse 44 of Luke. And they, supposing him to have been in the company, went about a day's journey and sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto them, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that you sought me? Wish ye not that I must be about my father's business? And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. So, before we get into this passage, I'd like to tell you a little about my burden. I have a burden for our people. I have a burden for myself. I have a burden for our young people. And the burden is like this, that, one, that we will be swept away by the values of the world. And number two is that we will be deceived by the deceitfulness of riches. And I'll tell you what, these two are a deadly combination. The thing about deception is that when we are deceived, we do not know that we're deceived. That is the nature of deception. Yes. This deadly combination will steal from us all the true riches that God has for us, and we will think this is normal and it's okay. It will take from us a truly meaningful life. It will steal time from our families, from shepherding our children and from our communities. It will steal time from living joyously with the wife of our youth. It will make us skip out on opportunities to be a blessing to others and to serve in tangible sorts of ways. It can also create burnout in our lives. Deceitfulness is given as a characteristic of riches. Riches have this strong personality trait. Riches tend to deceive. And when I think about some of the things that give me the most angst in my own life, when I think about my children and about the values of the world and about this deception, I want to know, what can I do to be different? What can we do to make a difference so there's something for my children? The question I ask myself, well, I have lived a life. Well, I have pointed them in the right direction that they can then develop the correct tools for the needs in their life. Or will I, by my own actions, have showed a false sense of value? You know, what we pass on to our children is called heritage. To the degree we are deceived by the world and systems, to that degree at best, will we have nothing to offer our children. We cannot give what we do not have. So I think about the goals for this message. I'd like to think about a lifestyle. We first have to have a mindset, and then we have to have a lifestyle. So I have two goals here. First, I'd like to explore the thoughts to be thought about this. And I'm sure this is not all of them, but I'm just going to share some of the things that I've thought about. And then I'd also like to explore the possible practical implications of those thoughts in our lives, how the rubber is going to actually meet the road. To do this, I'm going to try to use a threefold approach. We're going to look at Scripture. We're going to look at this story of Jesus. We're going to use that kind of a springboard to start. And I would like to think about vocation. We'll be less susceptible to distraction in our lives and failure if we know where we're going. And I think about the story here of Jesus. We see that 12 years of age, he already knew who he was and he knew what he was doing. He knew where he was going. He had a vocation. He had a work. Yes. The second part of this approach is I'd like to look at some other scriptures, and I'd like those to help shape our thinking about what the Bible has to say about our businesses and about our work. Then I would also like to take a little time to think in a logical sort of way about what things we can reason through and to give us a cohesive path forward. We want to take these principles and truths, and we want to think and understand about how in reality they might give us direction for the future. This is applied knowledge and understanding, and I believe when we apply knowledge and understanding in the right way, that is true wisdom. Ephesians chapter 4. One verse here, the first verse, Ephesians chapter 4. I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. How many of us are familiar with this word vocation? Do we understand its meaning? Raise your hands up. All right, people under 25, raise your hands if you understand this word vocation. A little bit? All right, but let's talk about it. So vocation is a calling. Often it's used in a religious setting, but not always. People may have a vocation and they feel it's a life calling. Maybe it's to work as a physician, or maybe it's some other good work. Vocation is an identity. Vocation says, I am something. It is different than a job. In a job, you go to work, you get your paycheck, and you go home at the end of the day, but it's not necessarily your identity or anything that goes with you. It's just about money. You know, your job is a contract of labor between you and your boss, but it's not identity. But when you own the endeavor, it starts to become you and you it. And I think that is why Jesus talks to us about the treasure, that where our treasures are, there our heart will be also. And so when we think about vocation, I like to think about that we have to have the calling that we have in our hearts as to Christ and his kingdom and to our families and our communities, and that this is a lifestyle, this is a work, and this is what you're going to dump your heart and your lives, your energies into, and that this is a path forward. And by living that way, you will have something to offer your community around you and your families. But I'd like to ask this question about our natural businesses. Has our business become our vocation? Is that the life work you've been called to? Is to build fences and to sell lumber or pallets or houses or fish or whatever your business is? Is that your identity? So, as you think about your life this morning, maybe you could ask yourself a few questions. You might find yourself in different spots. Maybe you look at your life and you conclude that I am my business, and my business is me. Or maybe you feel that that's not how you want to be, but you lost your focus and you got distracted. Or maybe, I would say probably a lot of us find us in this spot, that maybe you're really not sure. Maybe you've questions about how this is supposed to work. You want to be responsible and pay for your bills, but you're not really sure how to sort it all out. Somehow you find it all kind of confusing. Why is it so hard to figure out? And I think this is an okay place to be, because if you've got that open questioning heart, from here you can grow. Maybe you find yourself in a different spot. Maybe you feel that if we're all spiritual enough, we wouldn't even need to talk about this. That our hearts and the tangible part of our lives would not need to cross over. That if we are spiritually enough, our temporal business does not matter. We can make all the money we want, and we can use it for good and for God. And if we're spiritual enough, that all this time and energy we spend on our business will have no potential to draw our hearts away. After all, it all belongs to God anyhow, doesn't it? So I'd like to try to think about some of those questions, some of those places you might find yourself. Before we do that, I'd like to go over this passage here in Luke first, just a little bit more. Because I think it's really important that we lay this foundation of our life, our vocation. And I think there's a lot to be gleaned from this story of Jesus and just very practical wisdom for our lives. So, here's Jesus and his parents come to find him. And here they found him. He was at the temple. And he asks them this question. Did they not know? Did they not perceive? He came as the Savior of the world, and they didn't get it. And so what he did? He went home. And he was subject to them. And I like to think about what did he do while he was subject to his parents. And the Bible tells us. It says that he increased in wisdom, in stature, and in favor with God and man. There's four things here. When we think about the Son of God coming, it says that he increased in wisdom. Doesn't God have all wisdom? Why does the Son of God need to increase in wisdom? The Son of God came to fulfill all righteousness. He came to live in an example, and he also came as fully man. Those he sat with in the temple were astonished at his understanding, and yet his wisdom was not complete. How can you grow if you're already finished? See this as a metaphor. And yet Jesus went through this so that he was supremely qualified to be the firstborn and the only begotten Son of the Father. In order to express himself as the Son of God, he became the son of a man. I like to think about, it says he grew in stature, a very physical attribute. The physical reality of maturing, something we can see. And I think there's something we learned here. People know from the wisdom of experience that young people are not ready for big jobs. They can tell by looking at you. You're young, even if you're impressively responsible. I think about that a little bit in my own life. I might just tell a little story on myself. When we lived in Caneyville, I had some responsibilities of some things to look after there in our community setting. And we had a new family that had moved in, and I was trying to help him sort through some of the practical things of life, work, and the place they're buying and fixing it up and different things. And I'm not sure what happened, but I guess we never really had a conversation about age. But for whatever reason, he perceived me considerably younger than himself, which actually wasn't the case. And it created some friction in our relationship. I didn't know it at the time, but at some point he finally ups and tells, he asked me how old I was, and I told him. And I said, oh. And it changed his mindset a little bit. And I just think that that's just the reality of the way things are. And I've run into that experience numerous times of seeing that how what we think about a person's age and their maturity level affects how much credibility we give them. And I think God intended it that way. It's okay. So if you find yourself in a place of responsibility and you're not getting all the respect that you think you deserve, it's okay. It'll be fine. Just be the person you need to be. But at the same time, I think we need to recognize that as a true principle of life. I thought a little bit about Elihu there in the book of Job. And he's listening, and he's quiet. He says, I am young, and you are very old. Wherefore I was afraid to just not show you my opinion. I said, days should speak, and a multitude of years should show wisdom. He understood how this was supposed to work. At some point he did have something to say. He couldn't hardly contain himself anymore. But he still understood this basic principle that young people, they still need time to be proved. Jesus shows that here in this example. It says that he increased with favor with God. Jesus was working on his relationship with God in this time of his life. And I think that's so important. Young people, that is the thing that you need to be doing, is you need to be increasing in favor with God. And so when you think about your life work, your vocation, until you get some of these things in place, you're not going to be ready to move forward with that. And I think about Jesus. Jesus was how old before he began his ministry?
30.
30 years old. Why did he wait till he was 30? The law said that a Jewish man was a man at 20. Did Jesus waste his youth? Did he fret while in with the years until the time? I do not believe he did. Wisdom tells us that there is a time for everything. Young people, this is your time to prepare for the work that is ahead of you. You're not ready to fix all the world's problems. You're to work on your own. But there are meaningful ways to engage with those around you at this stage. The Bible tells us that it's good for a young man to bear the yoke in his youth. I'm going to encourage you to embrace that. When you think about the Father's business and the things that you want to do, go ahead and embrace the yoke of today. And young men, I speak to you because you are strong. That's a physical attribute you have. Use it to grow. Do not squander your time. Do not waste your money. If you want to have a useful life in the future, now is the time to prepare. So as we're thinking about maturing, we're thinking about the work that God has for us in the future in our lives and our businesses, how that's going to tie in. How are we going to get this proper balance between God's work for us and our businesses, the tangible part of our lives where we're taking care of the needs? How's this all supposed to work? There's a couple other places I'd like to get some other places in Scripture we'd like to look at. The Proverbs 31 husband. Have anybody ever heard about the Proverbs 31 husband? Where do you think the Proverbs 31 husband is to be found? We can read about him in Proverbs 31. You got it. And what's he doing there? Proverbs 31, verse 23. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. A conversation I had back a number of years ago, working there in the stove shop, one of the other colleagues we had there, he came by and just kind of asked me a question. It was something out of hair about there. I can't remember if it was about the wearing of scarlet or some of those other things that we maybe a little bit weren't so sure about. I think I asked him at some point, or maybe he asked me, about, how would you feel about your wife buying a farm? And I said, well, I'm not exactly sure, but when I have provided well enough for my family that I can sit with the other elders in the gate, she has everything she needs to take care of. I said, maybe we will have matured enough then that she will know what farms to buy, which ones not. So, but here we see a sign of maturity. I don't know exactly how old the father or the husband of the Proverbs 31 woman was, but as I read this passage, there's a household, it's operating, he's sitting with the other elders. I don't think he was just a young man. Again, there's a time for everything. We might cover that a little bit more later. The next point I want to talk about, so going here through some things in Scripture. What about this verse where it says, having food and raiment, be content? It's a very simple piece of direction. It doesn't sound complicated. And yet, I wonder, how many of you feel like you really understand that and you know how to make it work well in your life? I don't see a lot of hands, so I think it's good that we can talk about it. So as I think about that, did we ever think about trying to live a lifestyle where this made sense? What kind of lifestyle would that be? And as I think about that, I think we have choices to make. I don't know exactly what all that entails. I think we could make a couple of very different kinds of interpretations, and I think it would at least be some attempts at doing justice that direction that's given to us. But as we think about the basic needs in our life, and if we're going to take an interpretation like that, we can make choices. We can make choices that either lead towards that or lead away from that. And that's the thing I want to focus on today, because we're all making choices and we're all headed somewhere, whether we mean to or not. So when we think about that verse, and as we ponder what it means in our hearts and in our lives, I'd like to think about what kind of choices are we making. The next point I have that I would like to think about is, does God need our money? In Acts chapter 3. this is the story of Peter and John. They're going to the temple. We'll read it here. Acts chapter 3, verses 1 through 8. Now Peter and John went up to the temple, into the temple, at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. And seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked an alms. And Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, Look on us. And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. Then Peter said, Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have give I thee in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Rise up and walk. And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. And he, leaping up, stood and walked, and entered with them into the temple, walking and leaping and praising God. There's a couple things I'd like to draw from this story. It's obvious. Peter and John didn't have any money. But you know what? Not having money did not keep them from giving. Not having money did not keep them from giving.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I like to think about it this way. Just think about it. If Peter and John had, instead of doing some of the things they've been doing, had been out fishing, just think how they could have blessed this poor man by giving him a few hundred bucks. Could have really improved his life. But they didn't. They didn't have the few hundred bucks. Instead, they gave him what they did have. And in this case, not having money was actually more of a blessing. I'm going to think about this, that sometimes having money keeps us from giving as effectively as we might. It's too easy. Get out that checkbook, write that check. Instead of putting time and effort into a situation. So I'd like us to remember that when we think about our work, our vocation, our businesses, are they doing that for us? Does God really need this money? I'd like to think a little about the question about whose money is it? I know from time to time, we think about our assets, the things that we have. We like to think that it's all God's and we're just stewards of it. But I wonder, is that really a fair way to think about it? Does God want blamed for our money? I thought about the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Flip over just a page here in Acts chapter 5. First verse here. But a certain man named Ananias and Sapphira with his wife sold a possession and kept back part of the price, his wife also being privy to it, and brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why hath Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and to keep back part of the price of the land? Whilst it remained, was it not thine own? And after it sold, was it not in thine own power? Why hast thou conceived this thing in thine heart, and thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God? And Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and gave up the ghost, and great fear came on all of them that heard these things. I think we know the rest of the story. His wife came in, asked the same question. She was carried away. But what a tragedy. What went wrong here? There was something wrong in their hearts. I don't know what about all the things that were motivating them, but they had decided that for whatever reasons, that they were going to give some. And that wasn't, I don't believe that was the problem, that they gave some. Peter tells them that wasn't the problem. The problem was, is that they were trying to make a claim about their money that was not true. They lied. They were trying to say they'd given it all to God, but really they hadn't. You know, it was their land. It was their money. The real problem was pretending it was God's when it was theirs. So I think about that in our own lives. If God has blessed us and we have some money, have some assets, we can give it away. We don't have to have it anymore. And if you choose to do that and your heart's right, God bless you. But I think there's a problem when we start looking at our assets and we wave our arm over our spread and we say, it's all God's. Reality is ours. Riches are deceitful. We do not want to deceive ourselves. There's some other people who wondered about money and whose it was. We can find that in Mark 14. Actually, I'm afraid I wrote my... Here it is. Mark 12. And this is the Pharisees. They come down to talk to Jesus. Mark 12, chapter 13. Mark 12, verse 13. The Pharisees came to him to catch him in his words. And they start saying by all the right things. Verse 14. We know that telling Jesus, we know that you're true. You don't care about any man's opinions. And in verse 15, they ask the question, shall we give or shall we not give? And he says, why are you tempting me? So he says, show me a coin. And he asks this question, whose image is on it? Was Jesus' image on that coin? Was God on that coin? Caesar was on that coin. I'm going to say is that the money system is owned by the worldly governments. When we think about God's values, you just don't see a whole lot that is rated in dollars and cents. I think we need to remember that. The money system is not ours. It's not God's. It's not part of the church. The money system belongs to Caesar. And I think as we go through our lives, I think we need to remember that. And it's okay to... as much as we can, kind of just let it be Caesar's. I think about riches and wealth, and I think about this. How would a person even become rich? How would he get there? And maybe there's a lot of paths to it, but I'd like to turn to James chapter 2. Verse 5. Hearken, my beloved brethren. Hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith, and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him? But you have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before judgment seats? Do they not blaspheme that worthy name by which ye are called? If you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, ye do well. So, I think that's a question we face a lot today. Maybe some differences from what it was many years ago. We live post-industrial revolution, and there's some challenges that go with that. You know, back in the day, people could only get so much done in a day. There's only so many hours. You can only produce so much with your labor, and almost always, if there was wealth, there was oppression. But as we think about that today, we think about our bank account, and is it starting to stack up? How are we getting that wealth, and who are we taking our cues from as to what is fair, what is not? We're going to talk about that a little more here in just a minute. I'd like to think a little bit about the rich man and Lazarus. And it says that he found himself in hell. And he lifted up his eyes and there was Lazarus. And it doesn't really implicate him in any other way than that he was rich and Lazarus was poor. I have a poem here that I learned a number of years ago. Now Dives, and this is referring to the rich man, he sometimes, that was an old English word for him. Now Dives daily feasted and was gorgeously arrayed, not at all because he liked it, but because 'twas good for trade. That the poor might have more calico, he clothed himself in silk. He surfeited himself on cream, that they might have more milk. And e'en to show his gratitude for the deserving poor, he did no useful work himself, that they might do the more. We see a warped sense of value there. Now, obviously, there was some humor there, some tongue-in-cheek. But when we think about our sense of value and the deceitfulness of riches, our values get warped. We have to remember that. Jesus wanted to remind us of true values. Here in Mark chapter 12, we were already there, but there's another story there. Mark chapter 12, verse 41. And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury. And many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he said unto, and he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow has cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. Jesus tells us we need to reevaluate our measuring system. It's not how big the pile is, it's how little the pile is when we're done. When it comes to money, big numbers in God's value system are not more. You do not need a big business to please God. I think about that, and I think about our congregation here, and I'm glad that we can even have this conversation, because I think there's a lot of groups where we couldn't even have it. So I'm glad that we can do that. I'm glad we're talking about it. I'm glad we're thinking about that. But I also realize is that there's influences, and they come in, and they affect us. I'd like to think about the Good Samaritan and the gospel. You know, the Good Samaritan, he was not looking for something great and important to do. He was not looking for a place he could dump a lot of money into to change the world. He was going about his everyday business. And this is the picture that Jesus uses as the definition of loving your neighbor as yourself. He was going about his daily business, and he reached out and helped. I think we need to remember that. When we think about the gospel and how Jesus came to spread the gospel, he didn't start with something big. He didn't use a lot of big finances. He didn't use big media. He didn't use long trips. He came on a grassroots level. He came to the house of Israel. He came to a particular people, and he worked among them, and he preached among them, and he made disciples among them. And they told me to go and do that. And that is how the gospel was going to spread. And we think about the gospel and about our drive to be part of that work. I think if we're going to be effective, we're going to have to go at it Jesus' way. And Jesus explains that for us. So we looked at another passage in scriptures. I'd like to shift gears a little bit here. I'd like to talk a little more down the path of thoughts of some other things. I'd like to talk a little about where we're getting our ethics and our cues from. Are we getting those from the scripture, from Jesus, from the church? Are we getting those from the world? If our vocation, of our business is going to be the Father's business, it's going to have to be something the Father can bless. Otherwise, it's going to be ours and it's going to be the world's. So I think we can talk about ethical practices in business. Many worldly businesses find that good and ethical practices are the most profitable. And why is this? There's a lot of selfish, unconverted people out there running businesses, and yet their businesses are working. And I think we can be tempted to look at their businesses and say, it's working, they must be doing something right. That's because God's ways work whether you believe in them or not. You do not have to believe that God's ways are more imperative for them to work. My limited experience with Amazon is they have terrific customer service. That if you want to buy something from them, they make it as easy as possible. If you want to return something, they make it as easy as possible. They send you that code. You have to drop it off. Don't have to pay any shipping. If you've got a handy way to do it, they'll even pick it up at your house. When they were a new upstart, they had to have excellent customer service. They were doing something new and trendy. People were not used to buying online. They weren't sure if it was going to even be safe. And, you know, mail order has had its challenges. But Amazon had a goal. They wanted to become a big company. They wanted to become the biggest company. And as a new upstart, they had to have a positive shopping experience for their customers. If they were going to give Walmart a run for their money, they were going to have to do better than Walmart. And it had to be totally safe. Amazon assumes all of the risk. And why do they do this? They want you for a loyal customer. They want your money. I don't believe that the Amazon marketing team have these practices and strategies because they're trying their best to follow Jesus' teaching and going the extra mile. Do not confuse that. I thought of a way we might be able to determine this. Do you think Amazon has ever been in a lawsuit? And do you think they've been able to settle it all peaceably out of court? In June of 2023, I just pulled this quick statistic, I didn't do much search on it, they had 40 lawsuits in 1 month. And in the following 12 months, it grew by 40%. I think that tells us right there that their values about dealing with customers have got a different place they go to than Jesus for the rule book. Amazon has good business practices because it is smart. Amazon has good business practices because it is profitable. I like to think about business from the angle of the scriptures. And I like to take a moment to think about wisdom. And wisdom versus smart. Wisdom is holistic. It provides health for a person or for people. Smart is more like about clever. It is a good way to achieve a particular goal, but it gives no indication of the worthiness of that particular goal. Our goal should be different than that. They need wisdom if they're going to have any long-term effects. Wisdom teaches us that not all things are appropriate at all times. So I think we have to take that when we think about our business, and I think we read that in the story of Jesus. There was a time for Jesus, and Jesus did his main work in 3 years. That was his vocation. That was his calling. And your vocation, your work is going to be different. You are not called to this world to die for the sins of the world, but God does have a work for you, and God does have a vocation for you. But I'd like to think about Amazon here a little bit, and what is normal, and where we're taking our cues from. Is normal the way that Amazon conducts business? Love thy neighbor is a different concept than is it fair? And how are we going to determine what fair is? Do we let the laws of the land determine that? Out in front of the courthouse, you'll see these statues sometimes. It's called Lady Justice. And in one hand, she has a sword. In the other hand, she holds the scales and she has a blindfold on. Blind to prejudice, but ready to weigh out fairness and to mete out justice with punishment if necessary. And as great as that concept is for the laws of the land and for a government, do we let that definition of fairness referee our businesses and our relationships with those that work with us? How everybody else is doing it? Let's just ask a simple question. If we're a business owner, we have people working for us, or just anybody in general, why do employees go to work? Is it so the boss can get richer? Usually no. They have their own hopes, their own dreams, they have their own base bills to pay, they have their own goals for their families, and so they evaluate their opportunities and they try to make the best of their situation. But when we think about loving our neighbor as thyself, if we're not going to be like the rich men in James who are doing the oppressing, that's the next thing that says there, is that we love our neighbors ourselves. We have to think about what things are valuable to us. And if each of you think about the things that are valuable in your lives, family, church, community, maybe some other things. As our businesses looking at those goals in our lives, that lifestyle that we feel would be pleasing to God and a blessing to our fellow man, is our business helping create that atmosphere? Is it helping achieve those goals? The values of corporate America do not apply to loving your neighbor as thyself. The corporate business model, in a very smart way, tries to figure out what their best chances are of success. They know that people have other goals and other values. And so they try to measure all these, and they figure out exactly how far can they push their employee before they're going to break them, they're going to lose them. I think about contracts. And there's a story out there written by William Shakespeare. It's called The Merchant of Venice. And in that story, there is a young merchant, and he borrows a large sum of money from a Jewish moneylender. And the Jewish moneylender actually hates this person. And he hopes that somehow in this situation there's an opportunity to get some revenge. And in the course of that story, instead of charging him interest, he acts friendly. Instead of charging him interest, he says, well, as a joke, he just wrote on the paper, 1 pound of flesh is what he's going to extract if the guy can't make the payment. Well, this was a merchant that was borrowing the money. He had ships abroad at sea. They were coming in well before the due date, and he felt like they were fine, and he goes along with it. And when that thing finally comes to the court of law, because the ships are lost and the merchant cannot make the payment, the lawyers that come in to deal with that situation first plead with him to take the money. Take double the money, take triple the money. And no, he is going to have justice. He is going to have his 1 pound of flesh. So he said, all right, we believe in fairness. This is what the contract says. Prepare your scales. Get your knife out. And you cut, and you better not get one bit more than 1 pound. And by the way, there's nothing in this contract that says anything about blood. And you know shedding blood is against the law. So cut. You want a fairness, you're going to have it. Well, he tries to backpedal. And the court does not want to let him off the hook. They finally confiscate all of his lands. But it's a story by William Shakespeare. But it exemplifies for us the uncaringness and the unfeelingness of the law and of justice. That is how the corporate world runs their businesses. We want something other for our lives. And I don't believe that we're here doing that today. But I just think about those influences and the way these affect us. What is our definition of fairness? Are we going by what we've talked people into? What they've agreed to? Are we looking in a holistic way? What do our families need? What do the people that are working with us need? What do their families need? A I'd like to talk a little more about septum versus riches. I covered this a little bit earlier. But there was another point I thought about why riches are so deceptive. And in Revelation chapter 3, the church there that he's writing to, he tells them that they're blind and they cannot see. And it says because they are rich. Let's just turn there. Chapter 3, verse 17. Because thou sayest, I am rich, and increase with goods, and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched, and miserable, and poor, and blind, and naked, I counsel of thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white raiment, that thou mayest be clothed, and that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thine eyes with eye salve, that thou mayest see. These people were not seeing accurately. Their riches had blinded them to the real needs in their lives. And I think that is true. It's just amazingly true when you think about what wealth does to people. I remember growing up, we had an acquaintance who had moved into our area just previous to us. And time and chance happens to every man, and hard work helps. But he moved there with a young, small family and $40 and everything he owned and a little trailer pulled behind him, and in a few years, he'd become a millionaire. And one of the things he told my father was, he does not know who his friends are anymore. And everybody needs friends. But his riches had gotten in the way of that. And it also blinded him to the things in his life that he needed to change. He was sitting outside on the edge of the church, and he couldn't integrate because he couldn't figure out who his friends were, and he couldn't figure out when people came to talk to him about the needs in his life, whether they were his friend or not. And that's how his life continued. And, you know, his children are not with the church anymore. It's a disaster situation. He's got his money. Time's moving on here. A couple of things I'd like to cover. I'd like to talk a little about the dignity of labor. In Genesis chapter 2, the Bible tells us that God put Adam in the garden to dress it to keep it. God thought it was okay for Adam to get his hands dirty. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, tells people to labor, working with their own hands, the thing that is good, so they have to give. Jesus came as the son of a carpenter. And I'd say that we need to embrace the dignity of labor. I worry about this mindset of being a businessman instead of being faithful to your calling and your vocation. There is nothing dishonorable in getting your hands dirty. Take that as a value and a goal. I think a little about Jesus and his eulogy of John. John's in prison. John's fixing to lose his life. And he asks this question, what did you go out to see? A man in soft raiment? No, Jesus was talking about a man of God. A man who was not scared to take life a little rough because he had work to do. I'd also like to think a little about money and about meaningful lives and about the values that we have when we say we may have these values, but do our lives actually reflect that? And I think if we're going to do that, we're going to have to somewhat take responsibility for what we own. If we own a business, we own assets. If we own a farm, we own assets. We may own a house. And if we do, that's a blessing. We don't have to pay rent. But in all these things, there's some accumulated wealth. It's easy to say that our business owns this, our business owns that, and we distance ourselves from it. And for paying our taxes, that's handy. We can kind of shuffle the money around a little bit. But at the end of the day, your name is attached to those things. You own them. You have financial gain there. And when the business sells, who gets the money? Maybe your business sponsors a good work somewhere. And again, if your business is doing that, and you're a business owner, you take responsibility of that. And I'd also like us to remember to think about that in the context of those who have helped our business get there and to provide the labor for those assets. If your colleagues have worked and helped produce an extra $100,000 in your business and you get to decide where it goes, it may mean that you're rich. Maybe use it for good work. But when is big enough? Does your business provide for your needs and the needs of others? And if those are taken care of, then what? Do we expand just because we can and it makes good business sense? Do you need that extra money? I'm sure you can think of ways to spend it. That's not hard. How does it affect those we're working with? If our business expands, do the people who are working with us have to pick up the tab? And does that actually help them obtain their goals and their values? If we pursue that path of the boss mentality, does that fit in with the vocation that we've been called to? Is that the Father's business? If you've managed your business so well that now you have some extra time, how will you spend it? Could it be invested into something of eternal value? I think of a motto that my father had, and I like to try to embrace on some level, and I often don't know exactly how, but it went like this: live simply so that others may simply live. Are we being good stewards with our time and our resources? I would like to plead with us as a group to shy away from consumerism. It's so easy. Again, I think it's one of those deceitfulness of riches that we feel that the next thing will somehow bring us some level of happiness. And yes, things sometimes are helpful in work and business. It's nice to be able to mash the potatoes up and put the screws in the walls. But as I think about America and all the consumerism and all the emotions that go with it, we are just very much affected by that. And I think we need to actively fight against that. I also think about a very strange paradox that can happen. In well-to-do communities, how that the poor tend to get marginalized. And this is really strange when you think about it in the gospel. And that in Matthew, there when Jesus is talking about John, and John is in prison, and John is questioning, did he get confused about who the Messiah was? In Matthew, the whole book of Matthew is pointing out that the Messiah is who he says he is. And here's the thing that Jesus says. He says, John, what was the Messiah supposed to come and do? And he says, we have done those things. I've done those things. My disciples have done those things. And do what they've done? The poor have the gospel. And I think about the well-to-do, it tends to callous us. We become like the man there, the rich man, who lives pompous every day and feel like that somehow we've earned and we deserve this. And if poor Lazarus out there would just get his act together, his life would be better. That is not what the things that God gives us are for. But we get to make our choices. And one of the things I think about is that we make our choices, and then our choices make us. And I'd like to go back to the story we started off with Sam and Ben and Joe, that each one of those men made a choice. And that choice set them on a journey that was going to affect them for many years of their lives. And I realized that those choices are not always easy to make. We have to make those choices for our lives. If we're going to borrow money, and how much, and how long it's going to take us to pay it back, and those sorts of things. But remember, we make those choices, and then those choices make us. If we are not proactive, we may find ourselves in a situation, yes, we'd like to give, but we have already chosen our master, and we cannot serve. The borrower is servant to the lender. And if we're going to find ourselves outside of those situations, we're going to have to be intentional. We have to be proactive. We have to set goals, I think often before the time comes, about what we're going to buy and what we're not going to buy, and where this business is going to go, and how big it's going to get. I've discovered in my own life, there are some things waiting to the moment is not a good idea. When if your alarm clock goes off early in the morning, and you're going to wait to the moment to decide whether you feel like getting up, it's always going to seem like a bad idea. I have to purpose the night before I'm getting up when the alarm clock goes off. Yeah. And I think buying can sometimes be like that. Yeah. And I think about the problem of waiting tomorrow. If we are not intentional, if we do not purpose in our lives that we are going to go in a certain direction, if we do not purpose in our lives that we are going to give, we'll do it tomorrow, manana, another day. And I think we also need to proactively think about if we do have things that we have committed ourselves to. I think we need to think about how can we be free? And maybe that we do have commitments. Yes, we have to meet those commitments. But also, in what other ways can we be free to give and to serve? And how can we be about the Father's business? I think we need some real assessments about how much it takes for us to actually live on. Also, think about if we worked one day less a week, would we give that? Or how and where would we give that? I remember a brother sharing with me a while back that he just had so much work, he didn't know how he was going to get it all done. It was coming into the shop. And it was such a problem. He couldn't get loose to go do some things he wanted to. He would like to be able to maybe participate in some community things, whatever, but just was tied down by all of his work in his shop. But as I looked at his business was doing well. He had money. He wasn't going to starve. And I told him, I said, you know, you've got a couple options here. So people are coming to you because they want you to do your work. If you shut your door one day a week, they're going to keep coming. I said, it's actually not going to affect your business just a whole lot. But if you want to give, you're going to have to make that choice. I'd also like to think about the power of collective. We can do more when we do it together. And I think about our own congregation, and I think about the pattern we want to set for the upcoming generations. We can all fight these battles on our own, but if we will fight them together, we'll be much more effective. There is a lot of potential if we do it together. And I'd like to think a little about our heritage, the heritage that we're going to leave our children. You know, most of us are fairly young in our lives. There's some of us here that are middle-aged. But I think for all of us, there's actually some still time to, if we think on our path and we want to change it, we can. But there comes a time in our lives when we can't do that. Solomon talks about that. He talks about the time when that a person cannot go out and do the things they used to do. When the sound of a bird, it's troublesome. He talks about when the almond tree, it flourishes, the hair is white, and there's no strength left. At that point, you cannot alter your life. And I think about when we get to the end of our lives and we think about where we have gone, what we have done. Are we going to look back at our lives and the places that we have spent and put our energies? Are we going to say we were about our Father's business? Or will we look back and say, in the end, that was my business? And I'm leaving it all, and who knows who will come after me? Will I look back with regret? I'd like us to go home and evaluate our lives, our pocketbooks, and our work schedules, and decide that if we keep going on this path, is this path going to take us where we want to go? Vocation, we have been called. Let us walk worthy of that calling.